Today in Studio 360, the well-behaved English, keeping calm and carrying on. Tell that to the men and women around Henry VIII.
It's a uniquely English story. Nobody else has this monster king, of whom we are actually perversely proud.
Writer Hilary Mantel. We'll talk about the big television and Broadway adaptations of her best-selling novels Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. Plus, small-town America of yesteryear was supposedly sweet and well-behaved, too. But exactly 100 years ago, Edgar Lee Masters messed up that myth.
He took on and critiqued the whole trope of bucolic rural America with the white farmhouse and the red barn and the brimming silo.
The Spoon River Anthology and its unflinching take on middle American life. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. But first, one of the most important museums in the world, the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, has just announced that it's removing, quote, offensive words from the titles and descriptions of art in their collection. Terms like Negro, Indian, Eskimo, exotic, and dwarf, among others. So, is this a long overdue update or a revisionist sanitizing of history? Bad PC or good PC? Which are exactly the kinds of questions I love to sort through with John McWhorter, who is an American Studies and Linguistics professor at Columbia University. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Kurt.
So, the Rijksmuseum is trying to be more inclusive and sensitive. That's okay?
No. They're taking it too far. To take those words away from works of art from a very long time ago is going too far, and in a way, implying that people of color and the others are more delicate than I think any of us are.
So there's a painting at the Rijksmuseum from 1900 that the artist called Young Negro Girl, that they are changing to Young Girl Holding a Fan. So as a black person, Young Negro Girl does not get your hackles up?
No. And I mean, we have to be careful because these meanings from language to language are different.
Right.
Negro might have a different shade in Dutch than it does
right.
in English. But I mean, I can honestly say I'm not hurt. I can say that I'm not in the brains of every other black American that I know. But I'm pretty sure that none of them are hurt either, as long as you don't call a painting that now. There is the now and there's the past. There's an ancient film clip that I had reason to look at a few weeks ago because I was asked to write a book review about tap dancing. Go figure. And in 1897, there's a clip of a little black boy, and he's tap dancing. The clip is called Dancing Darkie Boy. Big surprise. That's what you would have called that in 1897. Now, if they were showing that clip at a museum, it wouldn't do anything for me for somebody to change it to African-American boy dancing.
Well, and which gets to the point, and it seems to me the somewhat dangerous slippery slope, which is to say, 50 years hence, if we have changed all these things, it'll look like, wow, we were always good. There was never racism in this country.
That's right. Yeah, that would completely distort history.
Yeah.
Because last time I checked, you go to a museum in large part to see how the past led to the present. The idea is to gain a sense of the passage of time and what has happened during it. And we certainly don't want to pretend, and I mean pretend in the literal sense of the word, that things that went on in the past were uniformly either good or just okay. We want to see the bad parts, too. It's part of understanding our development as a species.
And one could, again, the slippery slopeness, one wonders, well, that those Goya paintings of the war in 1810 are really hideous. I don't want to see that.
Oh, of course. And then all the black servants in those paintings.
Right.
Pretty soon we don't want to see that was the status that black people
yeah.
were relegated to.
Yeah.
All of that sounds quite plausible in today's culture. So there does have to come a point where we allow that the past was different from the present and that we can stand seeing it.
Well, exactly. And do you think this issue of changing the names of paintings in a museum collection is connected to those who would like Huckleberry Finn to be assigned to students with the dozens of instances of its famous unsayable word removed from that novel?
All of this is evidence of a good thing, which is that in educated mainstream culture, it is now considered pretty much the moral equivalent of pedophilia to be racist. That's good. That's a wonderful thing. However, when it gets to the point that you're doing these things that have nothing to do with either making life better for people of color,
right,
or even offending people of color, it seems to me that it's a waste of energy, not to mention a distortion of history. And frankly, if you ask me, it becomes kind of fake. I mean, who really thinks that the writings of Mark Twain and the words that he chose to use are going to hurt anyone today? Or who really thinks that a person of basic intelligence can't understand that the word X in that book is not the same as a white person aiming that word at someone now? But I think that there's an impulse, and I understand it. If I were white, I'm sure I would be doing the same thing, an impulse to show that one is as pristine of that impulse as possible. I personally have it, to show that I'm not being sanctimonious. I have that same impulse with women and sexism. The things that I'll say, the things that I'll do, I want it to be clear that I am not a sexist, because if I were, that would make me an evil person. I thoroughly believe that, and there are times when I bend over backwards. That is what I think most white people today are doing, Ray, black people. I get it. But frankly, it gets to the point where it isn't really helping anybody but you. And that's where I start to question it.
Yeah.
For example, white privilege. And I've gotten in trouble for saying this, but frankly, I don't see why. The new fashion of saying, I acknowledge my privilege. Now, supposedly, that is a prologue to then going out and being active and helping, especially poor black people. You have to realize that you're privileged before you do it. But let's face it, today, there's a certain trope where you acknowledge your privilege, and that's the gesture alone.
It's confession.
Then it's confession. It's religion. And to me, that's, well, okay, now you feel good that you've acknowledged it, but everything would be the same for me and black people
right,
if you didn't acknowledge it.
Right.
And just went out and, you know, helped get the vote for some people,
yeah,
or work for Habitat for Humanity, yeah, or any number of things that you could do instead of sitting in your living room and acknowledging.
Yeah. And I wonder, in the case of the Rijksmuseum, I look at the museum world in the United States and in general, and it is a very white place that they are all concerned about it being too white and their collections being too white. And this does seem like a gesture to make it seem better without having to find a black curator, say.
Yeah, frankly, it's a lot easier to change these labels.
John McWhorter, thank you.
Thank you, Kurt.
John McWhorter teaches at Columbia University and is the author of The Language Hoax. So what do you all think? Is changing the titles of artworks reasonable and worthy, or an act of Orwellian prettification? Let us know at studio360.org. Removing retrograde titles and captions from museum walls might make history seem a little nicer. That is one kind of revisionism. But the novelist Hilary Mantel's historical fiction is revisionist in kind of the opposite way. In her telling, British history wasn't really very nice at all. In her books Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, she focuses on a lesser-known figure around Henry VIII, who has always been depicted as kind of a bad guy, a weasel, Thomas Cromwell. He was the son of a blacksmith who maneuvered his way to become the king's right-hand man. Both novels have been huge bestsellers, and they both won the Man Booker Prize, the big award for English language fiction. In fact, Hilary Mantel is the first woman to win it twice. Earlier this year, Wolf Hall was adapted into a BBC miniseries that aired on PBS.
You said in Parliament in a speech some 6 years ago that I could not afford a war.
Wars are not affordable things.
When I went into France, I captured the town of Terouanne, which you called...
A dog hole, Majesty.
How could you say so?
Ah, I've been there.
So have I, at the head of an army. You told me I could not lead my own troops. You told me if I was taken prisoner, the ransom would bankrupt the country. So what do you want? You want a king to huddle indoors like a sick girl?
That would be ideal for fiscal purposes.
That's Mark Rylance as Thomas Cromwell and Damian Lewis as Henry VIII in the TV version of Wolf Hall. Earlier this year, the books were also a new Broadway show, a two-part, five-and-a-half-hour epic, which was nominated for 8 Tony Awards. And unusually, Hilary Mantel helped write the theatrical adaptation. In between last-minute rewrites last April, she came by the studio and told me she's been obsessed with the subject for almost half her life.
I've been thinking about Thomas Cromwell for 30 years, almost ever since I began writing. I had it in the frame as a really good subject. And you wait for someone else to do it because it's so obvious. And as I saw the 500th anniversary of Henry's accession approaching, I thought, well, you know what? Nobody's done that yet. It's time I got to it.
And what when you say it's so obvious, what was so obvious about it to you?
It's the arc of his story, a blacksmith's son to Earl of Essex. And
in the 16th century, didn't happen.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Poor boys, if they were clever and lucky, they could get on through the church. And the church gave them status. But Cromwell didn't do that. He picked his own path. He didn't really climb the steps of the existing power structure. He just brought his own ladder and smashed it through the ceiling.
And it's interesting what an appetite there remains in this country, especially, it seems to me, for the Henry VIII story. Did you know that when you sort of embarked on this ambitious project?
I suppose that you're looking at an archetype here. You know, he's Bluebeard. He's straight out of the fairy tale.
He really is. And,
it makes sense the world over.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's a uniquely English story. Nobody else has this monster king of whom we are actually perversely proud.
Well, and indeed, your books and plays make him less of a monster than he has been made before, I would argue.
I try not to judge my characters, really. I try actually to see him through Cromwell's eyes. And he sees him close up and he sees him flawed. And he sees him frightened and he sees him cold and visited by ghosts and subject to bad dreams.
Yeah. And it's easier, I think, for readers, and perhaps one of the reasons for the success of the books, to walk a mile in Thomas Cromwell's shoes, who seems more like us than one expects 16th century hangers-on to Henry VIII to be.
That's right. He's humbly born. But again, it's an archetypal story, we all understand. It's the story of the boy who leaves home and he can't go back. He's always got to be going forward.
And he doesn't put on airs. There's a kind of populist, I'm just this brewer's boy.
He was a cultured and very clever man, but he didn't seem ashamed of his origins and he didn't pretend to be what he was not. That makes him almost unique in his time.
Yeah. I remember as a child, and when you were a child as well, the big Henry VIII fiction was A Man for All Seasons, which, among other things, made Thomas More, Sir Thomas More, the great hero that at that idealistic moment we were supposed to believe was the great hero of this story. Not so much in your telling.
We've almost deified Thomas More by making him something he would have despised.
Really?
We've made him stand for freedom of conscience and tolerance. Those were not qualities that Thomas More recognized.
As we see, because he was killing heretics like crazy.
He was indeed. And what he stood for was obedience to Rome and conformity in opinion. And if you did not conform to his opinion, he tortured you. And in extremis, burned you at the stake. So this makeover of Thomas More into a 1960s liberal, whilst extremely entertaining, and, yeah, you know, let's not take away from it, it was a very good play, a very good film.
Yes.
It has dominated the imagination of two generations, and it's time to look at that myth again, I think.
Well, I think that's what you have successfully done, is now you have changed the historical reality. for people.
Of course, you know, there's a tendency to excuse Thomas More, who was in many ways a great man, as if his persecution of heretics was some kind of weekend hobby. You know, he was a great man, except for this little penchant for torture.
Yeah.
But I won't have this because, you know, it was central to his perception of himself.
Yes.
He was proud of his record as heresy hunter.
Again, as I've said, you depict Cromwell as a guy who is relatable to modern audiences. He has this – his marriage is this respectful-seeming partnership. He thinks people ought to be able to read the Bible in English, which was illegal still. He's this – he pulls himself up by his bootstraps. Did you ever think, I might be putting my 21st century ideas of an idealized Thomas Cromwell onto him?
His person who strikes us as having a more modern mentality than his contemporaries. But I'm always conscious that we have to respect people for what they were in their own time. They weren't rehearsals for us, and they're they're not us in some kind of unevolved form. So modern isn't necessarily a compliment.
Right.
I'm trying to look at him as a man of the 16th century, but I'm trying not to slant him so that, as it were, he curries favour with the 21st century.
Just like like people turn Thomas More into a 60s liberal.
But we're all writing out of our own time.
Sure.
That's inevitable.
Yeah. You have been very involved, centrally involved in the plays, the West End and Broadway adaptations of these books. One of the big differences between the plays and the books is there's much more comedy in the stage version.
Well, the books are witty. They're droll.
Yeah.
It's you smile. In the theatre, that's not good enough. You've got to point things.
Yeah.
And you can do that so that a line that lies on the page and makes the reader smile becomes laugh out loud funny when actors are animating it.
So you've got one more Cromwell novel to go to finish your trilogy. Do you think that working on the play is going to affect how you write that book?
The third book's already well underway, and it is influenced in all sorts of ways by the theatre production, but not stylistically. That hasn't changed. What has changed is the insights I get from the actors, from working with them, what they give me consciously in discussion or subconsciously in performance. The two projects are running very happily alongside each other, the book helping the scripts and the scripts helping the book. I think, though, maybe it will change the way I write in the future because I'd love to write for the theatre.
Yeah. And why not? The options are there in front of you. But are you sick of Thomas Cromwell? Will you be goodbye, good riddance, Thomas Cromwell?
I'm more fascinated by him than ever I was. I still can't add him up. And I'm partway through the third book. And I suspect he will elude me at the last. And as soon as his head's off, he'll get up and put it back on again. He's that sort of man.
Exactly. And then I could talk about his relative a century later, Oliver Cromwell, whom I want to read the Hilary Mantel version of, but I guess I probably won't get to.
Well, my husband's under instructions, if I start talking about Oliver Cromwell, to shoot me.
Hilary Mantel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
The Wolf Hall 6-part miniseries is on Amazon Prime. In other words, binge-watchable right now. Hilary Mantel and I talked for around 45 minutes, also about her obsession with historical accuracy, about her next book, and about the time she considered murdering Margaret Thatcher. You can hear our whole conversation at studio360.org. Coming up, it was a book of poetry 100 years ago that provided one of the most unblinking looks at small-town America ever.
A church bell sounded mournfully far away. I heard the cry of a baby and the coughing of John Yarnell, bedridden, feverish. feverish, dying.
In Spoon River Anthology, residents created a portrait of their town, posthumously. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And all year long, throughout 2015, I have been following four listeners who made resolutions to take on a major creative project this year. Well, it's December. Time to see if they were able to make good on their promise. First up today, Garmin Herrig's dad lives in Washington State. He's a digital special effects artist who has worked on movies like X-Men and Harry Potter. But his first love is something quintessentially low-tech, calligraphy. And what he does isn't like seating cards for a wedding reception. Garmin's work is far more complex and ambitious. This year, he's been inking the entire biblical book of Proverbs. When I called him up recently, he admitted that for a while, he wasn't sure his work was improving.
A couple of weeks ago, I was sitting there thinking that, man, I'm doing all this lettering and I'm not getting any better at it. And then I went back in and looked through the pile of the things that I did in January, and I'm like, oh, yeah, it's a lot better.
Good. That's what we're here for. So as you focused on each of the verses of the book of Proverbs and reproduced them, has that made you a wiser person?
No, I'm not, but I think I've freaked out some people in coffee shops.
Really? As you work on them in coffee shops?
Yeah, like now in the morning, I get up an hour earlier and I head to a coffee shop and I do calligraphy for about an hour before I go into work. And last weekend, I was lettering Proverbs 19:18, and it says, "Discipline your son while there is hope, and do not desire his death."
Right.
And so I'm like working on trying to make it have a really nice layout. And then the woman kind of walks over to me and like, "Oh, that's really pretty." And then she reads the lettering and her smile just kind of disappears and she walks away.
That's hilarious.
And then I kind of felt like, you know, the guy, the street preacher that has, you know, the big sign that says the end of the world is near.
Yeah. You didn't say, wait, this is just a project. I'm not a crazy person.
I should have put a little sign on that says, you know, Studio 360 Creative Resolution on my desk.
Garmin's work for this project isn't as freaky as he's making it sound. It is beautiful and has a modern feel, even though the verses are in old-fashioned script and from the Old Testament. You can see a bunch of his work at studio360.org. We have also been following all year Maria Thornton in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Her 2015 Creative New Year's resolution was something totally different. She spent the whole year reviving her chops as a reggae DJ and musician. Lately, she's been less into playing other people's music than in making her own.
I think I've been most satisfied with the songwriting and the little pieces of poetry that come out of me. So that's been, I think, maybe the most rewarding part of it.
Maria is just finishing writing and recording three new songs.
The one that I've titled 300 Birds is almost finished. And so that's the one I'd like to wrap up here in the next couple few weeks.
Excellent. Can you just do a little a cappella?
I would love to. I mean, the bass line's a little boom, 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 just so you can feel a little of that. And then I greet them all with, "Morning, bird," and I tell them, "A shout out to all the living human. True that the new day begin at midnight. Early bird and greet morning sunlight. Well, me say 300 birds them in unison flew over my head, said, there's not today, there is just one. This one day forward, so every second, every minute, every hour." And it chant like that, and then it gets into the chorus, which sings something like, one.
Sounds great.
Out of many universe, one love, darling. And maybe the kids will do something like, one.
Yeah.
One, you know?
Okay, listeners, we are days away from the new year, so it is time for you to make your creative New Year's resolution for 2016. Maybe you've been wanting to finish that novel, or compose a violin concerto, or, I don't know, build a model of every bridge over the Mississippi River using nothing but Slim Jims. In any case, if you've got such an idea and this is your year to do it, let us know, because we may pick you to follow. To throw your hat in the ring, go to studio360.org/2016 and share your creative resolution. Or you can call us at 646-580-0360. That's 646-580-0360. You got to do it by midnight on the 31st of December. When books of poetry are published these days, they tend not to cause the kind of stir of an album by Adele. But exactly a century ago, there was a book of poems that was both a bestseller and a sensation. Spoon River Anthology was published in 1915. It was by Edgar Lee Masters. 200 poems, the speakers, all residents of the fictional Midwestern town of Spoon River, dead residents. And death has made them talkative. They tell us very frankly about their hopes and dreams and damaged lives. The poems took on taboo subjects for any era, like sex and abortion and suicide. And they painted a picture of everyday middle America that was not celebratory or pretty. Curtis Fox looked into Spoon River Anthology and its legacy.
Spoon River Anthology sold 80,000 copies in its first year and has never been out of print. I'll say that again because for poetry, that's pretty much unheard of. Since 1915, Spoon River has never been out of print. Edgar Lee Masters was already a ripe 46 years old when the book came out, and his previous efforts gave absolutely no indication that he was someone who would radically change American literature.
Masters anticipated modernism.
Douglas Unger is a novelist who teaches at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and at the Black Mountain Institute.
And I think what he did, consciously or not, is that he took on and critiqued the whole trope of bucolic rural America with the white farmhouse and the red barn and the brimming silo.
Harold Arnett.
Take this poem and its portrait of a man trapped by his life in rural America. Harold Arnett says he's a failure. We don't know why, he doesn't explain, but failure in those days usually meant bankruptcy. He speaks to us about his last moments.
I leaned against the mantel. Sick. Sick. Thinking of my failure. Looking into the abysm. Weak from the noonday heat. A church bell sounded mournfully far away. I heard the cry of a baby and the coughing of John Yarnell, bedridden, feverish, feverish, dying. Then the violent voice of my wife. Watch out, the potatoes are burning. I smelled them. Then there was irresistible disgust. I pulled the trigger. Blackness. Light. Unspeakable regret. Fumbling for the world again. Too late. Thus I came here, with lungs for breathing. One cannot breathe here with lungs, though one must breathe. Of what use is it to rid oneself of the world, when no soul may ever escape the eternal destiny of life?
So here we have a graphic poem about a suicide, where as soon as he pulls the trigger, he regrets it.
Fumbling for the world again. Too late.
Which makes you wonder, why did poems like this catch the popular imagination in 1915?
Edgar Lee Masters hit the heart of a disillusionment that was abroad in the land.
Well, I was sort of looking for that in poetry, I guess.
Probably a lot like readers in 1915, Matt Rasmussen was drawn to the brute honesty of Spoon River when he came upon it in his high school library. Matt's a poet now, and his latest book was a finalist for a National Book Award.
In my own life, my brother committed suicide when I was 16, and so I found in poetry a form of mourning that I didn't really see anywhere else. That was private, also in a way public, you know, it's sitting there in the library. And so those are the sort of the poems I gravitated towards, the darker ones. I think there's a few suicides in the book.
And murders and ghastly accidents and sexual violence.
He is, in many of the poems, questioning directly Victorian American values of the way women should behave, the way men and women should behave with each other, what marriage means, what family means. And formally what he did was he wrote a cycle of poems in which more is happening in the white space between the poems than actually happens in the poems.
Minerva Jones.
A sequence of poems that begins with Minerva Jones is a good example of how Masters uses that white space between the poems to tell a complex story.
It's obviously a very, very sad poem.
Minerva Jones is the village poetess. She is sensitive. She is intelligent.
Herbert Russell is the author of the only full-length biography yet written about Edgar Lee Masters.
We're dealing with a person who is herself not particularly pretty. She's also vulnerable because she is very much by herself.
I am Minerva, the village poetess, hooted at, jeered at by the yahoos of the street for my heavy body, cock eye, and rolling walk, and all the more when Butch Weldy captured me after a brutal hunt. He left me to my fate with Dr. Myers, and I sank into death, growing numb from the feet up, like one stepping deeper and deeper into a stream of ice. Will someone go to the village newspaper and gather into a book the verses I wrote? I thirsted so for love. I hungered so for life.
For all its candor, Spoon River is a masterpiece of euphemism. This poem is about rape and abortion, but those words never appear.
It's part of Minerva's character.
That's Kathleen Rooney, a poet, publisher, and educator in Chicago.
She might not put it that way. You know, I think it's obviously a monologue like these pieces are, and I think, you know, he was trying to write it as she might have chosen to represent that experience.
First of all, it's 1915, and one doesn't write or speak directly of such incidents. If anything, you do it indirectly.
She's raped by Butch Weldy.
Captured me after a brutal hunt is, in a way, more terrifying than, you know, had he just said, raped me.
And she is eventually the subject of an abortion.
She dies from it. I think the image that she presents in the poem is incredible.
He left me to my fate with Dr. Myers, and I sank into death, growing numb from the feet up, like one stepping deeper and deeper into a stream of ice.
Like one stepping deeper and deeper into a stream of ice. It's sort of morbid image, right? But beautiful in a way.
We hear later on about the man who impregnated Minerva Jones. We hear more about the doctors in Spoon River.
Dr. Myers.
Dr. Myers is a victim of the village, which is ironic because he himself has done a lot to save the village and its people.
No other man, unless it was Doc Hill, did more for people in this town than I. In all the weak, the halt, the improvident, and those who could not pay flocked to me. I was good-hearted, easy Dr. Myers. I was healthy, happy, in comfortable fortune, blessed with a congenial mate, my children raised, all wedded, doing well in the world. And then one night, Minerva, the poetess, came to me in her trouble, crying. I tried to help her out. She died. They indicted me. The newspapers disgraced me. My wife perished of a broken heart. And pneumonia finished me.
And pneumonia finished me. this is Masters' view of the village right here.
I think it's amazing that in just a few lines, Masters is able to show how multiple lives were ruined by this incident. And then, you know, you also get Mrs. Myers.
He protested all his life long. The newspapers lied about him villainously. That he was not at fault for Minerva's fall, but only tried to help her. Poor soul, so sunk in sin, he could not see that even trying to help her, as he called it, he had broken the law, human and divine. passers-by, an ancient admonition to you. If your ways would be ways of pleasantness, and all your pathways peace, love God and keep His commandments.
Mrs. Myers belongs to a group of the very religious that always got under Master's skin. She is very much a village moralist, and what she has learned about morality and religion is apparently more important to her than her relation with her husband.
So now you've got the full story of Dr. Myers' tragedy and Minerva's tragedy and Mrs. Myers. Between them, the reader then imagines the story and begins to put together the story of the interrelationship of the whole town. So the book is visionary in that way. There's no other cycle of poetry in the American tradition that did that.
There are at least two things about the creation of Spoon River that are kind of mind-blowing. The first is that nearly all the characters in the book were modeled on real people, many from the two Illinois towns where Masters grew up. The second is that Masters really didn't know what he was doing when he began writing it. He started it in mocking response to William Reedy, the editor of the St. Louis magazine Reedy's Mirror, which had been publishing his earlier, more conventional verse.
Reedy was a very good critic much of the time, and he was the one who told Masters that you really have to get away from this genteel, derivative, 19th century Moon June and Spoon stuff and give us real life. And Masters felt insulted after one of Reedy's exchanges with him, and so he sat down and he wrote 8 of the Spoon River Anthology epitaphs, initially just as a joke. They were a literary chip on the shoulder, and he sent these to Reedy and said, "Here, is this realistic enough for you?" And Reedy recognized their value, and Spoon River Anthology was underway.
The book turned out to be hugely influential in American culture. Sherwood Anderson read it in one night before writing his classic collection of interlocking stories, Winesburg, Ohio.
Not only Sherwood Anderson, but Sinclair Lewis in Main Street and Babbitt. And later on, certainly Thornton Wilder and Our Town.
Some scholars also point out the tonal echoes of Spoon River's anguished souls in the work of confessionalist poets like Robert Lowell.
I hear my ill spirit sob in each blood cell as if my hand were at its throat. I myself am hell.
After Spoon River, Masters wrote nearly 50 more books, but he reverted to the Moon, June, and Spoon stuff, and no one really reads those books anymore. He died in 1950. The headline in the New York Times made it clear why anyone other than his family and friends would care. Edgar Lee Masters dies at 81, wrote Spoon River Anthology.
Curtis Fox hosts the podcast Poetry Off the Shelf for the Poetry Foundation. Music in that piece was by the Claudia Quintet. Special thanks to Pike Malinowski and Katie Peterson. Still ahead this hour, ask Mac DeMarco what kind of music he plays. You won't get rock and roll or alternative or pop or any other category you've heard before.
Journalists now will call your music slacker, goofy, blue wave. I don't know. So
I don't know blue wave.
I don't know. I don't understand what it means. But so what I did is I made up my own term so that when they ask, I get the first punch in.
He'll reveal what that term is and play live. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Mac DeMarco is a 25-year-old musician from Canada whom everyone thinks is a goofball. Even Mac DeMarco thinks he's a goofball. But he deserves more credit than that. He records, mixes, and engineers all of his music himself, and he is prolific. And the music he makes keeps getting better and better. Let it alone.
Last year, Mac DeMarco released his third proper album called Salad Days to pretty much universal acclaim. His latest album is called, characteristically, Another One, a mini album of 8 songs, and he's going to play some of them for us today. Mac DeMarco, welcome to Studio 360.
How you doing?
Good.
Cool.
So you have sort of created a genre for yourself, which you call jizz jazz.
Yeah.
What is jizz jazz?
Journalists now will say, call your music, what do they call me? Slacker, dreamy, right. Goofy, I don't know. All these
indie.
Weird things. Yeah, indie, blue wave, I don't know. So
I don't know blue wave.
I don't know. I don't understand what it means. But so what I did is I made up my own term so that when they ask, I already confuse them, right? Well, you know, I get the first punch in. And then, this is kind of like, it's just a rebuttal to like.
So you want to pigeonhole me? No, I'll give it to
exactly,
you.
Exactly, yeah.
Would you play some acoustic jizz jazz?
I could do it for you, yeah.
Which will you play first?
I'm going to play a new song off the new album. This song is called The Way You'd Love Her. Yeah.
Excellent.
Okay. How's your heart been beating? How's your skin been keeping? How's the dreaming going? Since you came back home this time and left her out there somewhere. Told her how you feel, but never really got your chance to show her what it really means to love her. The way you'd love her. The way you'd love to love her. The way you'd love her. Closer to the ending, she's still out pretending. Prying eyes won't recognize the way she feels about him. She'll just go on living. The river keeps on rolling. Knowing all the time she'll never understand just what it means to love her. The way you love her. The way you love to love her. The way you love her. All right.
That was Mac DeMarco playing a very acoustic version of The Way You Love Her here live in Studio 360. Your process is interesting to me because it's all you. You record all of your songs on reel-to-reel after you've written them and playing all the instruments and then use that tape to teach the band how to play. Do they feel as though they're kind of left out of the party?
No, because that's the thing. I mean, even if I play the drums a certain way, my drummer kind of plays like George of the Jungle, so nothing I can do about that. And then my bass player, he doesn't really, like he's a guitarist really, but kind of self-taught, really wacky style. So I kind of let them do whatever they want. And then, yeah, that's kind of the thing. It's like, even though they're not part of the records, the live show is like a totally different thing. And I let them, give them microphones, they can say whatever they want. Sometimes very strange stuff. A lot of personalities in the band, so, you know, it works out, yeah.
So they're not necessarily hired for their virtuosic musicianship.
No, the reason that they're all playing with me is when I initially signed with the record label I'm on now, which is out of New York, it's kind of like, well, I guess I'm going to have to start touring a little bit more. And I was in Montreal, and I kind of looked around the apartment, and I was like, you guys don't have jobs? Like, do you want to go on tour? And they were like, yeah. So, yeah, now it's now they're like making a doctor's wage.
So no wonder people call it slacker music. You're keeping it real.
Yeah.
You have said that your first album, which was called Rock and Roll Nightclub, was a joke. I'm going to play a clip from one of my favorite songs on that record called Moving Like Mike.
Uh-huh. One step to the right,
so the joke is slowing down your voice to sound like kind of Tom Waits as a lounge singer? Or what was the joke?
Before I was trying to make this like, you know, really like heavy duty, like indie rock, like big reverb-y. And then I was, you know, I worked at a grocery store for a year and ended up listening to classic rock radio all night. And I was like, man, like all these like cliches and like motifs they use in this music are so funny.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I decided that, you know, it would be funny to do that. I was messing around, made some weird, like before Rock and Roll Nightclub, I thought guitar solos were so stupid. But now, oh, I love guitar solos, but, you know, crappy ones, you know.
Yeah. Will you play the title song off this little album?
I can give it a shot, yeah.
Okay.
On piano.
On piano. Yeah. On our big Steinway Grand.
Steinway Grand, baby. So confused, you don't know what to do. Afraid she might not love you anymore. And though she says she does and hasn't lost your trust, who could that be knocking at her door? Must be another one. Must be another one she loves. Must be another one. Must be another one she loves. Stops, and neither does the clock. Wishing for tomorrow, today. She still says she's true, so you start coming too. Just as that old knocking comes to stay. Must be another one. Must be another one. Must be another one. Must be another one she loves. All right.
That was Mac DeMarco playing Another One, which is the title track from his new album. Listening to that song and seeing you play that piano, you reminded me of a guy who was over there a few years ago singing and playing, Randy Newman as well.
Whoa, I love Randy. You got a friend in me.
There you go. There you go. So I have heard some fairly extravagant stories of you on tour, of lots of dudes naked and lots of drinking and all that. Do you do that because you're 25 and why not, or because it's part of the persona for the fans?
I think it's just, you know, where I came from, my friend group. I think that, you know, we all like to have a good time. For some reason, I think that a lot of the people that I've met and have become close with in my life are, like, fairly, like, sexually liberated. So they, like, don't really mind exposing themselves or, you know, getting naked or doing strange things. I think, especially where I come from in Edmonton, it's kind of like if you do that kind of stuff, somebody might kick your butt because, you know, they think you're, like, a homosexual or something. So that mentality coming from that was always kind of like, I want to annoy these people because they're like, they have pea brains inside their heads. So I think from that, you know, it's just moved on to a global level. But
yeah,
it's funny though, because I'm never the one that gets naked on the stage, even though I get the reputation. It's always like, you know, a bunch of my friends that are like peeing their pants up there and stuff. But
yeah,
you know,
it has been a pleasure, Mac DeMarco. This has been great.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Mac DeMarco's latest album is called Another One. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and have a happy new year. We'll be back next week, unless all the merriment
does us in. Meantime, we would still love to keep hearing from you. Let us know what you think of the show at studio360.org or by writing us a review on iTunes. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. The team here includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Elizabeth Kulas,
Caroline Lester,
Tommy Bazarian.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Nurse Ratched speaks out.
How many people in positions of power feel that they know best?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, part of Studio 360's American Icons from PRI and WNYC.